The debate over infrastructure spending is heated. That's true here in Wisconsin and across the country. But some places around the world are trying what's called asset recycling. We're exploring what it is on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. When the next Congress convenes next month, the issue of rebuilding America's aging infrastructure will once again be on the agenda. But with power split between Democrats and Republicans, finding a solution that works for both parties may be difficult. The concept of asset recycling is drawing some attention. Robert Poole is director of transportation policy at the Reason Foundation. That's a libertarian think tank based in Los Angeles. He's author of a new report called Asset Recycling to Rebuild America's Infrastructure. Robert, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Kate. It's good to be here.
So before we get into what asset recycling is, what is your assessment of the state of infrastructure here in the U.S.?
It's not crumbling, but there's a lot of unmet needs. We have highways that are really obsolete in many cases for the needs and traffic flow that is current and projected. We have aging water and wastewater systems all across the United States that lose a lot of water due to leaks. We have airports that are not up to the global state of the art, and they work okay, but they're not as good as they could be. So there's a lot of need for improvements to infrastructure, and the problem is how to pay for it and who should pay for it.
Right, because it seems that time's ticking here, and there is gridlock in Congress over how to pay for it. Why are we seeing such gridlock on this issue?
It's difficult. Well, one reason, just take highways, for example. The gasoline tax started 100 years ago when Oregon first passed it as a dedicated user fee, although it was officially a tax. And over time, particularly in the last 30 or 40 years, it has become seen as more of just a tax, in part because it's spent on a lot of other kinds of transportation that don't directly benefit highway users. But so in Washington, the federal gas taxes haven't been raised since 1993, and so they've actually generated about half as much purchasing power in real terms for highway building and maintenance and so forth. So that's a real problem. There's generally a reluctance of people to face up to what it really costs to operate, let's say, water and wastewater systems or highways and bridges. And so the idea is that if somebody else will pay for it, that would be great. And so that's why a lot of state and local officials really hope that Congress somehow will pass a great big spending bill on this that means they don't have to go to their constituents and raise taxes or user fees.
Which brings us to this concept of asset recycling. Can you help us by giving us a working definition of what it is?
Basically, it means for a government, typically a state government or a municipal government, to look at the revenue-producing assets that it owns, such as airports, toll roads, water, wastewater systems, anything that charges users directly, and see if there would be an interest in some private sector companies basically taking over on a long-term lease management basis and paying in advance much of the lease payments and the state or local government would use those proceeds to meet currently unfunded infrastructure needs for things that don't have a user fee attached to them. And some of the things that people are talking about are basic street repairs and refurbishment, other upgrades to aging water systems and wastewater systems, things like that. And so this is not the whole answer, but it could be part of an answer. And I have suggested in a recent editorial that this could be part of a bipartisan approach that Congress could adopt.
Talking with Robert Poole, Director of Transportation Policy at the Reason Foundation, looking at the concept of asset recycling and how to maintain and improve our infrastructure across the U.S. You can join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. What do you think about asset recycling? Perhaps you see a private-public partnership in your area that is working, perhaps not. Join in, 800-642-1234, or ideas at WPR.org. Can you help us by giving us an example of what some asset recycling might look like in practice?
Yes, sure. One recent U.S. example was the airport in San Juan, Puerto Rico. I had flown in and out of there a few times, and it was pretty much like 1960s. Mm. The generic kind of food and gift shops, and nothing much else, kind of decrepit facilities and so forth. So the government of Puerto Rico, about 6 years ago, put out to bid a long-term public-private partnership lease of the San Juan Airport. And the winning bidder paid most of the lease payments up front, which the government of Puerto Rico used primarily for paying off old debt, but also partly to upgrade their regional airports, which they have several, which the Commonwealth owns. And the airport has been transformed. It has state-of-the-art restaurants and gift shops and all kinds of other services that were never there before. And the terminals have been dramatically refurbished. The security lanes have been modernized. So it's by all measures, and the airlines love it. They're very happy with the improvements that have made the airport a much more pleasant time for people who have to change planes and spend 2 or 3 hours.
So that's
a big success.
Robert, what's in it for these investors? Why should they be shelling out the dollars to do this?
Well, they would like to have the revenue stream from the airport or whatever it is, revenues, but they also have to commit to a series of capital expenditures to upgrade and improve the facilities. So the art is seeing whether in a particular circumstance there's enough potential there that you can actually have the improvements paid for by the private sector in that facility that's leased. But without the prices becoming unaffordable for those who use the facility. And that's the key part of this deal. Chicago did a bad example a few years ago by leasing the parking meters, and that ended up having a significant increase in the rates and a high profit. There was really virtually no capital expenditure needed by the company. So the service was the same, but people were paying a lot more for it.
And so that specifically is what went south in the Chicago model there?
That went south. And also the city did not use the money to invest in new infrastructure. They basically used it for short-term budget balancing. And that's, you know, you can do that once, but you don't have anything permanent to show for it. Whereas here's another case. The state leased the Indiana Toll Road. Now, it already had a revenue stream, of course, from the toll revenues. And the private sector was able to repave much of it, rebuild and modernize the service plazas that people could stop at, and they put in electronic toll collection to speed things up. So there were benefits there. But the state got something like $2 billion worth of new highway improvements, a statewide program that was a big success politically. So this was a win-win for the taxpayers of Indiana and for those who use the toll road.
And we're going to get back to the Indiana situation. We're talking about a new study out by the nonprofit think tank Reason Foundation. Looks at how long-term leases could put money back into our roads, bridges, airports, and other aging infrastructure. Getting your thoughts as well, 800-642-1234. What do you think about asset recycling? Stay with us on The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. Countries around the world will need to spend $97 trillion updating their infrastructure in the next 20 years. That's from a report last year by the G20's Infrastructure Investment Hub. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're talking about a new study by the Reason Foundation that sees asset recycling as a way to capture hundreds of billions of dollars and funnel it into state and local governments for new infrastructure spending. We're talking about the asset recycling concept and getting your thoughts on it at 800-642-1234. How do you think we should fund our infrastructure needs going forward? What questions do you have about public-private infrastructure deals? Call in, tweet us at WPR Mornings. Robert Poole stays with us. He's Transportation Policy Director at the Reason Foundation Think Tank, and he's authored a new report on asset recycling. Robert, where we left off, we were talking about Indiana, and you pointed out such a success story. But at the same time, 2014, less than 10 years after the start of the lease, the operator of Indiana's toll road filed for bankruptcy. While the lease, you know, has taken over by a new company, it does raise questions about the stability of this kind of model.
Well, it does. In that particular case, the company used very what we call highly leveraged financing. In other words, it took out more debt than it actually cost them, and they had the equivalent of a balloon payment coming due about at the time when they filed bankruptcy, and the Great Recession that hit after the financial crisis had devastated truck traffic on the Indiana Toll Road. So their revenue just wasn't sufficient to make that large payment. So they filed Chapter 11. The good news, though, it turns out to still be a big win for the state and for taxpayers of Indiana. The new company that won the bidding is a consortium of U.S. public pension funds that actually paid more than the original lease price. And so the bondholders were made whole. The taxpayers of Indiana did not put a penny into that project because the new operator, financed by the pension funds, did a very conservative financing with about half of it was equity and only about half was debt. So they are insulated from future, if there's a future big recession that causes traffic and revenue to go down, they have a lot of wiggle room that the original company didn't have. So it's turned out to be still a very much big win for the state and the taxpayers and for users of the toll road.
So they're not going to be hit by a perfect storm that they just didn't see coming.
Exactly. The whole industry, the whole toll industry, public and private, learned a lot from what happened in the aftermath of the Great Recession. Mm-hmm. And so the forecasts now that on which bonds are being financed for toll road projects are much more conservative than they were prior to the Great Recession.
So when we're talking airports, we're talking toll roads, are these companies that lease these assets free to do what they want to them?
No, you actually, a big part of this is a complicated, like 500-page contract that spells out the government oversight. And the government oversight includes on a toll road, for example, or an airport, limits on the extent to which there can be increases in the rates charged to customers and airlines, and in the case of airports and cars and trucks on the toll road. So that's legally spelled out in the agreement. There's all sorts of performance measures that can include financial penalties. And there's actually always in these deals, there's a provision for the state or the government party to terminate for cause the agreement, which means throwing out the company. And the company, because it signs that agreement up front, understands that it could lose its investment if there's a termination for the states for cause by the government. So that's a very powerful motivator to live up to the terms of the deal and to meet the performance requirements.
It seems Australia has been doing this. As you look internationally, what have you seen abroad when it comes to asset recycling?
Well, the country, Australia, as you mentioned, and it's in our report, is the country that really put the term into the language. They started, the federal government in Australia created an incentive program for the states in Australia to sell or lease revenue-producing assets and use the proceeds for other infrastructure. The federal role was to say, if you do this for a particular facility, we will give you 15% of the net amount that you receive from the deal if you commit to put all the proceeds into new infrastructure. And so that the Australian national government used a few billion dollars to generate about $20 billion of transactions by state government, mostly New South Wales, which is where Sydney is located.
Let's take a call now. Let's go to Pat joining us from Wauwatosa. Hi, Pat. Good morning.
Good morning. Well, I just woke up to listen to this program. I'm assuming he is speaking to the tollway when he's speaking of the facilities along the road in Indiana.
That's correct.
Yes. Well, you know, I've driven that many times. For years, we avoided having to stop in Indiana. The facilities were so poor. And in last year, we went, and I must say, this is just about the worst example of privatizing. They seem to have two floor plans, my daughter said, small and smaller for the stations where you stopped to rest areas or if you wanted food and outside you could buy gas. And in the plan, they forgot to provide a storeroom. So every place we stopped with these new facilities, you tunneled through little boxes where they forgot to provide in this small, square, bright, new, well-lit. It is one of privatizing is not always the best. States have to be willing to spend money and do it right. When you go into Ohio, the contrast with the beautiful places they have along there, they've been working their way west on the state highway.
Pat, thank you so much for those observations. Robert, you know, she sees a stark contrast when she goes across the border between Indiana and Ohio.
That's very disturbing to me, and I wonder if the state of Indiana has had proper oversight of that refurbishment. If in fact they're finished, and they did held an opening ceremony a few months ago saying that the job was completed, I'm very surprised what she has said, and I don't doubt that she's reporting it accurately and seeing the contrast with Ohio. But the state may have been a little bit falling down on the job if those facilities are not finished and still have stuff stored out in the open, which strikes me as a very poor way to do.
You seem confident that this is something that both political parties can get behind, but could you see that Democrats arguing that any kind of privatization is a slippery slope and be hesitant to get behind this?
I can certainly. I've had discussions with the staff on this subject last year, the incoming chairman of the House Transportation Committee, and his staff was not cool. They asked me to come in and brief them on it, but when they really started to think it through, they were not happy with it. Well, and I don't see the Democrats as being wild about this idea, but I think if you're going to have a bipartisan measure, the Democrats are going to insist on more federal spending. The Republicans deserve to get, you know, their piece of, you know, their priorities. And so my idea of a compromise would be that things like asset recycling and a greater federal encouragement for public-private partnerships would be one of the things the Republicans offer in exchange for accepting the Democrats' insistence on new federal spending. So that's the scope of a possible compromise that I've outlined.
Are you looking at federal government or states really to lead the charge on this, do you think?
I'm looking at the federal government to provide incentives and to remove federal obstacles to public-private partnerships. There's only a limited amount to which these deals can use tax-exempt revenue bonds, and so that could be expanded to make these deals more financially feasible. And if the financing costs are lower, then the rates, you know, the rates that customers pay would be lower proportionally. So there are things that the federal government could do to get to make it easier without being directly involved. But almost all the infrastructure that needs refurbishing is owned by state governments or municipal governments. So it's really up to the federal government to either for some combination of providing additional funding and making it easier to do sensible things at the state and municipal level.
Why don't we see more of this going on at the state and municipal level?
Well, there is a fair amount in the highway field. Six or seven states have done billion-dollar scale public-private partnerships to add things like express toll lanes to expressways. That Virginia, Texas, Florida, and Colorado are among the leaders in doing that. We've only seen the one airport so far in the United States, although Congress recently, a few months ago, liberalized the law so that it make it easier for airports to be long-term leased in the way that Puerto Rico did. So this is early days in the United States for the long-term PPPs, as we call them. But Europe and Australia and the larger countries in Latin America have been doing this for several decades. So there's a lot more experience overseas than we have here.
Well, Robert, thank you so much for joining us.
I'm delighted to be here. Thanks for having me.
Robert Poole is Director of Transportation Policy at the Reason Foundation. He's author of a new report called Asset Recycling to Rebuild America's Infrastructure. Coming up next, as the nation reflects on President George H.W. Bush's legacy, we talk about the role of his funeral will play and how it fits in with those of past leaders. That conversation after the news. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. You're with us on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Today, the nation begins its memorial for President George H.W. Bush. In 1986, then Vice President Bush stumped for gubernatorial candidate Tommy Thompson here in Wisconsin. He was at Eau Claire North High School's gym.
Tommy understands why America is back is more than a slogan. Some don't understand it, but most Democrats, all Republicans, all independents understand what it means is when we say pride and respect is back in the United States of America, and Tommy can help keep it back.
Wisconsin went on and elected Republican Tommy Thompson as governor in 1986. The state did not go for George H.W. Bush 2 years later, though, when he ran for president. Former President Bush died Friday. This afternoon, members of Congress are part of a ceremony at the nation's capital. Bush will lie in state in the rotunda. And as the week unfolds, people across the nation will pay their respects. It's a combination of tradition and the personal wishes of people who served in the Oval Office. We're looking at the significance and hearing your thoughts on memorializing a president at 800-642-1234. Which presidential funeral comes to mind when we talk about the protocol and the personal connection? What do you remember about watching the memorial unfold? Join in, email ideas at WPR.org. Let's bring in Brady Carlson, author of the book Dead Presidents, an American Adventure into the Strange Deaths and Surprising Afterlives of Our Nation's Leaders. He's also Wisconsin Public Radio's host for All Things Considered. Brady, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Kate. Great to be with you.
So we as a people here in the U.S. expect presidential funerals to come with certain traditions. Who decides what a presidential funeral includes and does not include?
Well, there's a playbook, so to speak. Army Pamphlet 1-1 is what it's called, and that's the protocol for a state funeral. And by law, the only people who are automatically afforded a state funeral in the United States are presidents, former presidents, and presidents-elect. So in a lot of ways, the presidential funeral structure is built on those traditions. It involves a lying in state in the rotunda in the Capitol, like we're going to see today. It involves a military honor guard and all of the circumstance and pomp that comes with that. That said, though, a president can override pretty much all of that if he or she chooses to. Some have chosen not to have a state funeral at all, like former President Nixon in 1994. But most, and it seems to be the case here with former President Bush, that they tend to follow that state funeral tradition in large part and then throw in a few personal touches here and there to look back at their particular lives and particular legacies and particular interests.
Let's look at lying in state in particular. What part of that honor is really ingrained in this tradition, and what is the process of lying in state?
Well, lying in state means essentially that the nation is paying tribute to an individual. That's slightly technically different than lying in repose, which is something that, say, for example, Rosa Parks had when she was, after she passed away. She was in the U.S. Capitol at that time, but technically a state funeral is different from these other honors. It's a slightly higher level, I guess you could say. But just in the ground level, so to speak, it basically means that you're going to have a large public procession. People can come and pay their respects at the Capitol. There are going to be long lines in and out of the Capitol for the next 36 hours or so when President Bush's casket is there inside the Capitol. And there's going to be a lot of people talking and remembering and paying tribute to the late president as that's all unfolding.
Congressmen will be waiting in line as well. Why is it crucial that the president involves Congress?
Well, technically, Congress is in charge of the Capitol. So when a president, in this case, President Trump, were to issue the formal declaration that a state funeral is going to take place, he has to notify Congress, which then has to make the official designation that they will open the Capitol up for that part of the ceremony.
We're talking with Brady Carlson right now. He's the author of Dead Presidents. We're looking at the pomp, the circumstance, the tradition around presidential funerals as we mourn the passing of former President George H.W. Bush. You can join in with your remembrances as well at 800-642-1234. As you think about past presidential funerals, what comes to mind? What parts of the tradition do you remember that stick out to you? 800-642-1234. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. Outside of Washington, D.C., outside the Beltway, Brady, when do other people really get a chance to memorialize a president who has died?
Oftentimes that will take place in the president's home city. In this case, President Bush spent part of his year in Texas, in the Houston area, and then also in Kennebunkport, Maine. So we've already started to see some memorials and tributes popping up outside the Bush family compound in Maine. There's George H.W. Bush International Airport in Texas, so there have been some tributes there as well. So you'll see some of that happening. There's a joint guard of honor that the military puts together because the military is in charge of conducting the state funeral. And so members of each branch of the military will take part in attending the remains of the former president until the time that those remains are brought to Washington, D.C. And then afterwards, once the official state funeral pieces have come together in Washington, the rest of the state funeral is carried out wherever the president has chosen to be interred. In this case, at the grounds of the Bush Library in Texas.
Right. So in College Station, Texas, there'll be another funeral as well. And then that is where he will be buried, at his presidential library. Is that unusual or not?
That's become the standard for presidents since the start of the presidential library system in the 1940s. Every president from President Hoover on pretty much has chosen that, with just a few exceptions. President Lyndon Johnson is buried on the grounds of his family home in the Texas Hill Country. Mm-hmm. And as I understand it, President Carter has planned to be interred in his hometown of Plains, Georgia, even though the Carter Center and Library is in Atlanta. So with few exceptions, presidents these days tend to have their remains put in the presidential library.
When I think of presidential funerals, one of the traditions that stick out to me is the bugler playing taps. And it's this moment when, you know, people stop talking and then there's this peaceful stillness. And then there was the bugler at President Kennedy's funeral who missed a note. What is the significance of taps?
Well, taps is an old military tradition. And so the president being commander in chief, of course, is part of that same tradition. You mentioned the bugler at President Kennedy's funeral. That was one of two moments that that did not go right in this very elaborate and carefully planned funeral. People knew that the bugler had basically just missed the note, because that happens sometimes. But in a way, it was almost as if, in the same way that a person's voice can break when they're talking about a loved one who's gone, the bugler sort of captured that same spirit. There was also a riderless horse named Black Jack, who was a famous part of that funeral. Now, Black Jack had gotten spooked before the ceremony by a loud noise and was kind of an unruly horse to begin with. But the fact that he was kind of trotting about out of place when everyone else in this long funeral procession was being so careful and being in step, he seemed to mirror the grief of the nation as well as a horse can, anyway.
Former Secretary of State James Baker was with Bush when he died, and they were friends for decades, 60 years or so. Baker then appeared on all the Sunday talk shows, revealing those final moments and remembering Bush's accomplishments, the legacy Is there planning in that too?
Most likely. It would not surprise me to say in the same way that a person might ask for another president or a close friend to deliver a eulogy, mm-hmm. that they might say to friends or close political friends and allies, yes, I would like you to be out there for me to help people remember what my presidency stood for, or the issues that I fought for, and make sure that those come out. Presidents make sure as they plan these things, and President Bush helped, I heard, plan this for over a decade. They want to make sure that things are carried out in a certain way so that the messages, whatever it is that they want the nation to remember them by, is out there for people to hear and see.
Tom from Burlington called in to say at a state funeral, it's important to have catharsis and to cry together. He said the English take a long, slow procession, play a sad song, and that helps people come together.
Yeah, and that's a lot of why we have these moments together. I mean, presidents are really one of the few cultural figures that we all share anymore. We don't all read the same books, we don't watch the same movies, we don't listen to the same musicians, but we do all have the same presidents, even if we don't feel the same way about them as other people in the country. But we have that shared experience of having lived through the Bush presidency or whatever president it is. And so coming together, talking about what that was like, who that person was, and how they affected the country is something we can all do together.
And people and pundits are discussing whether President Trump will attend or have a role in the funeral. Our current political climate plays into that conversation, but how does that fit with the way we usually watch the who's who when we honor presidents after they've died?
Well, certainly people watch to see who's speaking, who's sitting near who, who's saying what. There's a famous line from President Nixon's funeral. Of course, he worked for 2 decades after resigning from office to try to clear his name over Watergate and try to have the rest of his record put together. And President Clinton, who was in office at the time, said, and I don't know if I'm getting the exact wording right, but he said, "May the days of judging President Nixon on anything other than his whole record come to a close." Particularly meaningful to President Nixon, who wanted people to not just think of Watergate when they remembered him. At the Reagan funeral, people were paying attention to see whether his children were sitting together, because they had had some family feuding when he was in office. So you notice those kinds of things. And while President Trump is certainly going to attend this funeral, from the reports I've read, were a sitting president not to take part in that, or to not be asked to take part in that, would certainly be noticed.
A letter written by President George H.W. Bush for President Bill Clinton is being widely shared on social media as a tribute to the late president. We're talking about presidential funerals and the protocols of memorializing a president. You can join in, 800-642-1234. WPR's Brady Carlson is the author of Dead Presidents. He stays with us here on The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. Wednesday is designated a national day of mourning as our nation remembers President George H.W. Bush, who died Friday at the age of 94. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We're looking at the significance of state funerals. The tributes have poured out from fellow presidents to Saturday Night Live skits. People are paying their respects to the 41st president. We've heard mention of Bush's civility toward his adversaries, suggesting it could set an example in today's more toxic political climate. WPR's All Things Consider host Brady Carlson is author of the book Dead Presidents. We're looking at the process of mourning, the tributes and dedications. Yours too, 800-642-1234. What do you wonder about the process of a presidential funeral? Do you appreciate the tradition, or do you question whether it's relevant in modern times? Call in. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Brady, our last presidential funeral was in 2006, so it's been more than a decade since we've seen the official government response when a president dies. How does it start?
It starts once the sitting president of the United States issues a formal declaration. Now, that's different from a statement. And of course, President Trump put a statement out saying that he and the First Lady mourned the death of President Bush. But there is an official proclamation that puts that day of mourning in place, and it also directs the U.S. military to begin planning the official state funeral. That's when he notifies Congress to ask for the use of the Capitol Rotunda for lying in state and all of the military pieces that come along with that. Typically, what also happens is that the president designates the days when there's going to be funeral activity in Washington, D.C. as a day when government offices are closed. Part of that is to show respect for the former president. A lot of it is also because the procession really geographically moves all over the Washington, D.C. area, and traffic is already so bad in that area that having you know, a military procession moving through town would
tie everything up.
Yeah, so yeah,
they have political gridlock, but we'd have
but this is traffic
this would
gridlock.
Be a whole new level of gridlock.
So that just sort of clears the field so that they can move things and people around.
Well, take us way, way back to the 1800s. How long ago was it that we started this official part of the process?
Sure. This dates back to 1841. Now, previously, presidents had gone into office and then they returned to private life for the most part. So their funerals and their burials were in private ground. There were no state funerals back then. That changed in 1841 when the sitting president of the time, William Henry Harrison, died after just 30 days in office. And it happened so abruptly that the vice president was back home in Virginia. He wasn't even there. And so the cabinet had to kind of improvise what they were going to do. And they felt, this is a young nation. We want to show we're every bit as good as the kings and queens of Europe, and so they decided to use an elaborate system. They draped the White House in black cloth. That's one tradition that we haven't kept up. Nowadays, they just drape the portrait of the president in black cloth. But they wanted to have a large ceremony to honor not just the president, but the presidency itself. And so that's when you started to see riderless horses and large funeral processions and things like that. So many of the traditions that they basically just threw together quickly in the aftermath of President Harrison's death have carried on through today. I will note one interesting fact about that. You noted how people tend to come together and talk about civility in the aftermath of a president. There's one exception to that from the death of President Harrison in 1841. One of his predecessors, former President Andrew Jackson, wrote to a friend at the time and said, "God has seen fit to remove this horrible ruler from us so that he could not destroy the country." Fortunately, Americans have tended to be more forgiving in the years since, but it is not unusual for people to come down hard on a late president. That happens sometimes, too.
So a memorial and funeral for a president is an enormous undertaking. Tax dollars actually pay for this. Why is a presidential funeral so important that we pay for it with public money?
Well, one is if you're going to have the military operate it, they're part of the government. So, you know, you're starting the person who's officially in charge or supervising a state funeral is the Secretary of Defense, and then it moves on down through branches of the Army. But really what it says to me is it speaks to the unique relationship that we have with this one office. It's the only office that, at least theoretically, everyone participates in. The president represents all the people in a way that members of Congress don't, that governors don't, that other elected officials don't. And we also have this personal feeling. People who never met John F. Kennedy will still tear up when they remember those 4 days of nonstop TV coverage of that somber funeral, that riderless horse, that procession, just hearing those drums and hearing the taps, hearing seeing the eternal flame laid at Arlington Memorial Cemetery. So there's a uniqueness about the presidency and the people who have that office. We have that personal connection with them that we have with few other people in public life.
Are presidential funeral plans public information, or is this confidential?
Well, the playbook that they use to plan these, that Army pamphlet, is publicly available. But the personal touches that presidents put on their funerals, that's very hard to get hold of. It's something that is often coordinated between the military, between other branches of the government, and then usually carried out through a president's library system. When I was writing the book, I tried hard to get hold of information about some of the funeral plans, and it's hard to come by. You usually don't know what's going to come for sure until it actually happens.
What do we know about a president's casket and the ability to walk by it and pay respects?
Usually they are placed on top of something of a civic relic called the Lincoln catafalque. A catafalque is just a fancy word for a casket stand. And this casket stand was put together out of pine boards very quickly after the death of Abraham Lincoln, the assassination in 1865. And at first it was just seen as a temporary stand. And then someone said afterwards, you know, this was the stand that Lincoln's casket stood on. We should probably hold on to this. And so that's something that they only bring out for state funerals. It's not something that gets used very often. So to be placed on top of the casket stand that Abraham Lincoln's casket was put on, that Kennedy's casket was put on, that so many other presidents and important figures have been placed on, sort of symbolically ties all of these people together through history and through time, which is a kind of a very special touch.
And before we look at what you're watching for as this week unfolds, what is it like in the rotunda as this casket is there on view? People are crammed into the rotunda. It must have a different feel than business as usual.
Yeah, it's a moment where people really do take time to reflect. They look back at the life and accomplishments of this individual president. They look back at what that person has meant to the country, what they've done, what they've tried to do. And so oftentimes they'll look at it and compare to today. You know, some of the things that President Bush was proudest of in his presidency were bipartisan deals, things like the Clean Air Act and things like an economic package that that was difficult to pull together politically, but the two sides managed to make a deal. And we talk so often today about how hard it is to make a deal. So it may not be something that winds up in changing politics, but it is certainly something that people think about when they look at modern politics.
Well, Brady, it seems like you eat, sleep, and breathe presidential funerals and the history rooted in them. What are you watching for this week?
It's always interesting to me to find the little touches that have meant something to a president. For example, President Bush has asked that his remains be brought to their final resting place by train, which is not something that we've seen since the funeral of President Eisenhower in 1969. So that's an interesting touch. I remember when President Ford died a little over a decade ago, he wanted his hearse to go by the World War II Memorial because he had served in that war and he wanted to pay tribute to his fellow veterans. So those little touches, and also just the sight of for all the other fellow presidents coming together, other people in the country, members of Congress, and people like you and I, you know, just watching and learning and listening together as we remember a person who's held the office that means the most to the people in the United States.
Well, Brady, thank you so much for coming in, joining us today. Appreciate it.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Brady Carlson is the author of the book Dead Presidents, An American Adventure into the Strange Deaths and Surprising Afterlives of Our Nation's Leaders. He's also Wisconsin Public Radio's host of All Things Considered. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and you're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. Stay with us.